This is David Harlow on Health Blog, and I'm speaking today with Dan Graydon, who's the head of eHealth Product Management at Aetna. Good morning, Dan.
Hey, good morning.
Well, thank you for taking the time to be with us this morning. Dan, I had the pleasure of hearing you speak at a recent conference on Health 3.0. And while we may debate the definition of Health 3.0, what I heard from you about what you're doing at Aetna was fascinating. And I'd like to ask you to speak a bit about your work in connection with the personal health records online access tools for Aetna members and how that allows them to be engaged with their physicians in managing their own health care.
Great.
I wonder if, just for starters, if you could describe what the tool is and how patients are accessing it.
Sure, David. We built our PHR as part of our Aetna Navigator secure website, and that was a deliberate decision from the beginning that it should be part of the rest of our members' online experience. It's not a separate tool. It's highly integrated into all their other interactions. And what we focused on was building a tool that helps them be better consumers of their healthcare and providing them a resource to make better decisions, be more engaged with their healthcare providers. And so our approach was really to go beyond just putting the data on a secure site. But what we chose to do is really marry the data that we already have through our normal healthcare plan operations with our care engine, analytical engine that our Active Health Management subsidiary provides us, so we could really provide value to our members by continually analyzing their records and reaching out to them and or their physicians when we find an opportunity to improve their care or be more engaged to better manage their care through that analysis of the records. So even though we call it a PHR, it's really much more than just a record online. It's really a tool and a resource that our members can use to be more engaged and better consumers of their healthcare resources.
And what about their clinicians? What access or inputs to the PHR do the clinicians have, and how do they use that information?
Well, the first and the primary way that our members share the information with their physicians is by printing it out. We had that ability in the product the day we launched it, which was just over 2 years ago. It was February 14th of 2007. Since then, we've added additional capabilities to have the physician access the record when the member provides that permission. So in other words, the member is always in control of who sees their record. They have to formally delegate the access, we call it, to someone else, whether it be a physician, whether it be a family member, that type of thing. But the way it works electronically is that the member can go online, choose the physician that they want to access their record, and then if the physician is using our Aetna provider portal, which is part of a larger set of resources that Navimedics provides. It's a company that provides tools for physicians to automate their practices. When the physician staff or office is going on and doing something like an eligibility verification prior to the visit or even perhaps submitting a prior claim, if the member has delegated access to the PHR, it will show up as part of that activity. And there will be a prompt that asks the office, hey, your patient, your member has asked to share this with you. Click here to print it. We also can send care alerts or what we call care considerations, the alerts that the care engine identifies to the physician that way. So if there's an opportunity to improve care, we deliver it via that channel as well.
Now that's a very interesting additional tool. Now how are those care alerts generated, and what are they based on?
Well, what the care engine does is it takes the claim-derived data from a multitude of sources. It's not just medical claims, but also pharmacy claims. We look at lab claims. Often we have lab results as well. And it goes through and it does several types of analysis. The first is it will go through and try and identify the potential presence of certain medical conditions. And so it's not just taking the way the claims are coded as the basis for the presence of a medical condition. It'll look for more evidence beyond that. So if we use the example of a diabetic, we'll see whether the the claim code in the ICD-9 or the CPT-4 or whatever, you know, suggest the presence of diabetes. But those are often rule-out diagnoses, the way the physicians code the claims. So we'll also look to see, all right, do I see prescriptions that would be consistent with someone managing diabetes? Do I see lab results that would be consistent with someone managing diabetes? And based on what that analysis provides, the care engine then may say, you know, I have reasonable cause to suspect this member may have diabetes. I'm going to go through and do an additional set of analyses to make sure that all the best practices of care related to a patient with diabetes are being followed. So, for example, is this member, you know, is this patient taking a low dose of an ACE inhibitor? There's been recent studies that have proven that a very low dose of, you know, say, lisinopril, for example, 5 milligrams, for example, can, in the long run, significantly prevent complications with kidney function. And if the member is taking a script, that's great. No action will be taken. But if we see that the member is not taking it, we'll send a note to the physician as well as to the member, just informing them of this potential opportunity. You know, we're not drawing any conclusions. We're just introducing the topic for further discussion and further exploration between the member and their physician. So that's an example of how diabetes would work. There's literally hundreds of different opportunities to improve care that are analyzed, and dozens more medical conditions that are.
You were saying that there are dozens of conditions for which there are these care management protocols in place or alert potentials in place. Mm-hmm. And I am wondering whether you have the potential to overload physicians with information about these various alerts that go to physicians or they go to patients as well.
The potential is there to overload physicians with the results of this analysis.
Yes, I mean, there's the potential, it seems to me, to provide so much information that the physicians could potentially be overloaded with information on a variety of conditions for a large number of patients.
The way that that's been managed is, and first of all, that's a great question, and the way that that's been managed is twofold. One, you know, I mentioned how the analysis for the presence of a condition is fairly rigorous. It doesn't just look for the claim coding. It looks for other data that would corroborate the presence of the condition, so that it reduces errors that way. But the I think the primary way that that's mitigated is through what we call the alert urgency. You know, we don't send physicians just routine preventive care, and the way that the alerts are communicated to the physician also is a function of the criticality. So a level one urgency is a life-threatening situation that we may have identified, whether it's a drug-to-drug interaction risk or a drug-to-medical condition interaction risk, you know, in rare cases, you know, a drug-to-family history interaction risk. The type of thing a physician may not have recognized on their own, but is potentially life-threatening, that will typically be made through a phone call with follow-up fax. The less urgent ones are typically sent by mail or fax. And the ones that really involve the member being proactive or, you know, engaging in preventive care are not sent to the physician. So through the tiering of the urgency of the alert and the means through which the alert is delivered, we've been able to manage that pretty well. Active Health has been running the care engine for, boy, a little over 5 years now, I think, about 5 years. And so, you know, it's the staff of physicians who run this part of that business. So they've been pretty sensitive to, you know, what warrants an outreach and what a proper form of outreach is based on the content.
And the care guidelines that they use are based on peer-reviewed journals or data from your network or a combination of both, or how does that work?
They're really more of an expert than I am on this, but I know that they continually review peer-reviewed journals and include that. There is analysis going on of the informatics work within our databases, but it's really a lot of the feedback that they get suggests that this is a means for physicians to learn about new findings in various fields. And the ACE inhibitor one is a good one. That's a couple years old, still being understood throughout the physician community that treats people with diabetes. And so they often get feedback on care considerations from the physician saying, thanks, I didn't know the study. Your note prompted me to look into it, and I'm going to start changing my treatment approach.
This system has been in place for 2 years now, and I'm wondering whether you have done any sort of systematic review of quality of care improvements, cost of care reductions, any sort of tracking that's been done to date?
You know, we track that extensively, but because we started our pilot 2 years ago and we've really only had a meaningful user base for about a year, we're just now starting to see some early indicators of the improvements in care. And so we're really at the, we think, the tip of the iceberg on that. But what we are seeing is a few things. People who use our PHR generate significantly more of those care considerations, those care alerts that I talked about. That's a good thing for medical costs because we've seen through other work in our the care engine from Active Health Management, which has been up and running about 5 years, that the more alerts that are generated, the more opportunities we have to improve care and lower costs. So the PHR makes that care engine program and its ROI more effective. We've also found that the compliance to those alerts is higher for people who use our PHR. We think it's for a few reasons, but one of them is that we're sending the notice to both the physician and the member in some cases, so there's better follow-through. That improvement is over 4%. So early indicators are that these are the users of our PHR are much more likely to have a medical condition, and the PHR helps them be more engaged with their care. So we do expect, as we have more of a experience base to do our informatics work on, that we'll continue to see very specific cost savings.
I see. Now, you say this is this was done as a pilot for a year, and it's been out of pilot. So how many patients or what proportion of your membership is using this actively, and how do you measure that?
Yeah, that's still changing pretty rapidly because, like I said, so many of these deployments have happened recently. I mean, to give you a specific number, about 85% of the membership who has our PHR have had it for about 7 or 8 months or less. So it's relatively new to most of these people. In terms of how we measure this, we don't just measure, you know, what percent of the people who have the PHR have used it. Now, obviously we do that too, but what's more relevant to us is, you know, who are they, what is the value delivered to these members through the PHR, and then really focusing on making sure that we continue to build out the right capabilities to help them be better consumers of the healthcare. And as an example, we have much higher than normal usage among people with a medical condition, as I said. Also, we see higher usage among, you know, mothers with children. They're doing things like accessing immunization records or other health data across, you know, multiple kids or even a single kid. And we also see the pre-retirees use it more. Now, what's important to note there is that while there's similarities, there's different value delivered to each of these members based on how they're using the tool. So our measurements around adoption really tend to focus more on who is using it, what they're using it for, and what the value delivered from that is.
Sure. Now, do you have a sense of sort of what proportion of your membership is using this in some regular fashion?
Yeah, well, it continues to grow significantly every month, and we do measure this regularly. For example, right now, over 10% of our subscribing members, these are the ones who, you know, subscribe directly to the health plan, have accessed their PHR, and that's higher than the industry average. We expect that to continue growing. Mm-hmm. And a little clarifying point, those are the members who it's easier for us to communicate to. Those are the ones who, through their employer, subscribe to the plan, and their dependents, for example, their minor dependents have a PHR, but the parent accesses it for them. So we have to count those.
You're not counting those other family members in your percent.
That's right. I mean, we do look at that as well, but I think the more relevant measure is the one
the
I gave you.
Subscriber rather than the member, I guess. Okay. Have you thought about additional bits and pieces and functionality that could be added on? You said a moment ago that different people access this and use it in different ways depending on their personal situations. Has that has looking at that given rise to thoughts about expanding the functionality of the tool?
Oh, yeah. We we have a very long list of enhancements that, you know, are on our product plan in the forward years. I think the best way to describe it is our plan was based on, you know, an assumed evolution of this. So because it's a new tool, right now this is just simply about building awareness of the tool and what it can do for people. So a lot of the more recent enhancements have been to help people delegate access to the record or bring other people to access their record. You know, we talked about how there's a tool where a member can delegate access to their physicians, but we haven't talked about a new capability we launched where a member can delegate access to their family members. So, for example, I went on when we shipped this enhancement a few months ago, said, all right, now my wife can access my record. I don't know whether she's done the same for me yet. I have to check. But, you know, what's interesting about that is if a member does that and their, you know, spouse or other adult dependent, for whatever reason, isn't registered on our websites yet, we built it in such a way that they can invite that member by sending an email to any email address. It's from the member themselves, and it's an invitation to come online with Aetna and access their PHR. We borrowed from a lot of other social networking sites, such as Facebook, in designing that. So our focus has really been on how do we just create awareness and that initial experience with the PHR, and then down the road we'll be building a lot more integration of the PHR to other activities within the health plan.
I see. And I guess the other area that I was interested in thinking about here is sort of plans for the future in the context of new legislation. Now, I know it may be too soon to be planning this out, since I don't think the legislators who voted on this have even read it yet, let alone the rest of us.
Well, in my sense, is it very directional at this point, but more detail to come.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right. There are a couple of areas that I did want to sort of explore with you a little bit, and I guess the first of those has to do with security,
yeah,
of the online security of this information, which I imagine has been a big part of the design up front.
Yes.
But the HIPAA regulations in the future look like they will have more technology-specific direction in there, mm-hmm, and whereas up until now they've really been technology agnostic, if you will,
mm-hmm,
and HHS is being directed to come up with more specific requirements that will be updated on an annual basis in conjunction with industry stakeholders. So as an industry stakeholder, I'm wondering if there's a particular architecture that you are more comfortable with, or security architecture and systems, and whether you have some cause for concern where this could be changing on an annual basis.
Yeah, I mean, again, it's really too early to, I think, have concern, but I know that in our case, we've all, you know, invested in heavily in this security, both not just in a technology framework, but both in it, but also in operational protocols and protections and processes long before we even had our PHR. So what we found is that, you know, this was a logical extension to our security environments already. I know that in the case of the data sharing work that we've done as part of the AHIP working group, the America's Health Insurance Plans working group, mm-hmm, I think that was a very good approach in defining an industry standard that works well amongst the larger community of stakeholders. And so if we see something like that evolve out of this, I expect that would be constructive.
Yes, yes. And hopefully that will evolve. As you said, it is very early.
Yeah, I mean, you know, one thing I also see is that you know, something like a PHR, it's obviously not limited to that, but something like the PHRs, this is new to everybody. And so it's an opportunity for the whole healthcare community to really raise awareness among, you know, the rest of the population who doesn't think about this stuff all day long, you know, to explain the benefits and so on.
Right. Now, one of the other issues that jumped out at me was a section of the new law that addresses the ability of an individual to restrict access to information in his or her medical record, and that is that a patient can ask an individual provider not to share information with insurance companies if it's not for purposes of treatment or payment. And I imagine that currently the PHR that you described that you're using captures a lot of such information. And I'm wondering whether you've had any pushback or feedback from patients about, or members rather, what information should or should not be in this PHR.
Yeah, the way we've approached that is, one, again, we make it clear over and over again that the patient or our member owns their record. They're in control of it. They're in control of what's in it. They're in control of who sees it. Doesn't get shared with
them. You are much clearer about that than many others.
Yeah, that's true. And I think there's a few reasons for it. I mean, when we're not a hospital, so I think potential confusion about kind of the ownership of the data that others might have doesn't exist for us. In terms of the details of the language, I don't know it, but we already support the idea that the member can choose not to share parts of the record or choose not to share the record at all. We even have built the capability saying, for whatever reason the member wanted to exclude parts of the record from a specific delegation, a specific sharing, they can do that. So I think generally it's consistent. I would also point out that we encourage sharing the whole record. A lot of what we're doing here is trying to encourage a more open and constructive dialogue about members' health.
It's hard to connect the dots if you don't have access to all of them.
Yeah, and I'll actually give you a very specific example of how we, really pushed for some of that. State privacy laws are such that there's a lot of information about minors that can't be disclosed to anyone by us, including their parents. So we built, instead of taking the choice of saying, all right, well, parents can't access their minor child's PHR, which obviously isn't the right thing for a lot of people. We said, all right, we'll build some additional capabilities in order to comply with state privacy laws where the types of information that are, specifically addressed in the law are filtered out of the view. So the parent is still seeing 98 or 99% of most records, but specific content about whether it be reproductive health or substance abuse treatment that state privacy law explicitly addresses, that's filtered out. So we get the benefit for the vast majority of the people by still having parents able to access their minor child's PHR while still complying with state privacy law. And that to build that capability, we had to spend some of our resources to do it, but we felt it was the right thing.
Sure. So that can be applied to any of these other situations where disclosure would be limited.
Yeah.
Or
yeah.
Permissions would be can be customized.
Yeah.
Different providers or different folks that who access the information.
That's right. And from my perspective, the fact that the legislation is even having fostering the discussion on this is a great thing.
Yes. Is it your sense? You did just say that. It would make sense for people to share information more freely. Do you have a handle on whether that is in fact what's being done or whether people are keeping some information close to the vest, if you will?
Yeah, we in our case, a lot of the sharing features are fairly new. So it's hard for me to, I don't have enough data to really draw any conclusions yet. But what I can tell you is that when it's shared, sharing it by paper is still the most common. It's an interesting thing, but when we did research not long ago, the vast majority of physicians, even those that practice in an environment that have an EMR, use paper.
Yeah.
So,
I'm familiar with that in my own paperless office here.
Yeah, exactly. I have piles everywhere in mine. But
that's the mode of communication. That's interesting.
Yeah, and
There is a physician module for this, is there not?
Well, the way it works is through Aetna's provider or physician portal, we've added the delivery of the PHR onto existing workflow that was already built there.
Yeah.
So, in other words, our assumption, our view on this is that we don't want to ask our providers to take an additional step.
Right.
So when they're...
Somewhere else.
Mm-hmm. Pardon me?
Don't need to log in somewhere else.
Oh, gosh, no, no. They log in the same place, and when they're doing other work that they already need to do with us, such as verifying eligibility of one of their patients for coverage, in some cases submitting a claim, as they do those other steps, we can layer delivery of a personal health record onto that activity without them really having to do any additional work. You know, a classic scenario is a member of the staff goes in the morning of the appointment, the night before, verifies that there's coverage in place, and they verify the eligibility, and if the member has delegated the PHR to that physician, it's delivered via that same activity.
Right.
You know, and just to kind of close the loop, I mean, what we find is they've told us, yep, and we print it out, and we stick it in the folder along with everything else.
This is all very interesting, and I understand it's a work in progress. I guess I've asked this another way before, but do you see sort of a particular growth curve in terms of additional functionality or additional utilization by patients and physicians? This has sort of taken off in the past year.
Yeah.
Do you see it continuing to grow or sort of leveling off in the next year or so?
No, I think we're really just getting started in terms of the people who can really benefit from a PHR becoming aware of these tools and what they do. I'm not one who believes that a PHR is valuable to everyone, though. I think
I was just going to ask that. Is the goal to have 100% adoption?
No, I think there's better ways that we can engage those we call them the young and invincibles. Realistically, someone who is at a point in their life where, for whatever reason, they're not even generating medical claims, obviously we'd like it if they were doing their preventive care, but there's a lot of our population who just don't use their resource, their clinician resources and medical resources at all. We have different ways to engage them that are more effective and more relevant than the PHR. But I think we're really still at the beginning of getting the part of the population that would benefit from the PHR to understand what they are, understand that they have one, and then try it and, see how it delivers value for them. Yeah, we'll, in our case, we're continuing to deploy this tool pretty rapidly, but last year, I think we touched on these numbers earlier, but we went from around 1 million at the very beginning of 2008 to over 7 at the beginning of the year. We were just deploying it aggressively. That, we're getting past the midpoint there, so that's going to slow down. So we'll start to see a lot of these people who've gotten it recently have it for some time, have the marketing that we have in place to make them aware of it start to kick in. And we're already seeing a pretty nice growth in the awareness and the adoption.
Yes. Well, very interesting, very interesting, and it sounds like a very valuable program as it's being rolled out. Well, thank you. I've been speaking with Dan Graydon, head of eHealth at Aetna. This is David Harlow on Health Blog, and once again, thank you, Dan.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you.